Hi, welcome to the Behind the Balance Sheet podcast, where we meet leading investors and commentators and educate ourselves about the world of investing and the world. Our mission is to remove some of the mystique around investing and improve our understanding of what makes a successful investment, or indeed an unsuccessful one. Our goal is to inform, educate, and entertain. We hope you enjoy this and every episode.
Behind the Balance Sheet and affiliates and podcast guests may own shares or have an economic interest in securities discussed in this podcast, which is aired for your education and entertainment only. Nothing in this podcast should be construed as investment advice or relied upon for investment decisions. Always do your own research.
Are traditional expert calls in the investment world becoming obsolete? According to Stream, they are, and you can access primary research easily and efficiently through their platform. With Stream, you'll have the right insights at your fingertips to make the best investment decisions. They offer a vast library of over 26,000 expert transcripts powered by AI search technology. Plus, they provide competitive rates on expert call services, and you can even have an experienced buy-side analyst conduct the calls for you. But that's not all. Stream also provides the ability to engage with experts one-on-one and get your calls transcribed free of charge, all for 40% less than you would pay for 20 calls in a traditional expert network model. So if you're looking to optimize your research process and increase ROI in investment research spend, Stream has the solution for you. This podcast is intended to educate and entertain, but we also have a more serious purpose. We support the Financial Times Financial Literacy Charity. Check it out on ft.com/flick. It's the most disadvantaged in society who get taken in by financial scams, by payday loans, and similar artful devices designed to part people from their money. We can change this. It's a straightforward task of education. This is a great cause, and I urge you, please, to support it. Mario Gabelli is the oldest investor I know and one of a handful of highly successful fund managers who were managing money in the 1970s and still do so today. He is something of a legend, and in this interview, he explains his framework for identifying companies that will generate long-term performance. He believes in doing deep industry research, looking at the total supply chain, reading the 10Ks, of course, but also reading trade journals and regularly visiting both the companies he invests in and their competitors and suppliers. He's funny, self-deprecating, and a workaholic. The day after I interviewed him, he was getting on a flight at 4 a.m. to visit the Genuine Parts Investor Day, which started at 7:30 a.m. in Atlanta, Georgia. This guy is a billionaire and in his 80s. He still loves the markets. He not only manages money, but he's out visiting companies, not just in the US, but in Europe and Asia. He says he looks to recruit PhDs like he used to be, but these aren't doctors of philosophy. PhD, Gabelli means poor, hungry, and driven. His net worth was put at $1.7 billion by Forbes, but he's certainly still hungry and driven. My idea behind this podcast was to inspire young people to have a career as an analyst, which has been so rewarding for me personally. Mario Gabelli started work in 1967 as an autos analyst, and he's still following Genuine Parts 56 years later. That has to be fun, right? You're going to enjoy this one. So Mario, listen, welcome to the podcast. I'm really grateful to you for coming on. I'm really looking forward to our discussion. And what I normally ask people to start with is, how did you get into investing? Now, I know the story, but it's a fantastic story. Please share it with the listeners.
Well, it's a funny story. I grew up in the Bronx, New York, and somehow I was taken to a golf course called Wingfoot, well known among golfers, and they allowed you to caddy without asking how old you were. And I was like, 12, and the age was 13. When I got to be 13, I swung over to a different golf course in Westchester County, which is just north of New York City, called Sunningdale Country Club. In fact, the pro was a fellow by the name of Whitey Voight. They had a son, two sons. One is a famous rock star, and the other one is John Voight, the famous actor. So I actually caddied for John Voight while he was an assistant pro. Independent of that, I would be able to go up because I'd either go by bus or some other transportation like hitchhiking, which was okay at that time in that time period. And I would stay late because I had total flexibility on my schedule. The other caddies would leave. Individuals would come up to play nine holes of golf. I would caddy for them, and they were specialists on the New York Stock Exchange, and they would talk about how they were making money that day. So that's when I started buying stocks in the probably seventh or eighth grade started reading the newspapers because, you know, that's, you'd get an evening newspaper that gave you the closing prices. So I started buying stocks like Beach Aircraft, Pepsi Cola, AT&T, Philadelphia and Reading, and that was it. So during high school, the same thing, college, the same thing. But when I went to graduate school and I took a course from a fellow by the name of Roger Murray. He was the successor of Columbia Business School to Graham and Dodd. I decided I was become what they call a security analyst and do research on stocks. So that's it. Not complicated.
And you're still doing research. How many years later?
You know, I would like to tell you that I'm one third the age of the United States, but that would create someone trying to figure out what happened in 1776. So for your audience, I don't want to get into that. I've been doing it for about 60 years. I started with a firm called Loeb Rhodes in 1967, covering the autos, farm equipment and conglomerates, and quickly picked up business services and media and entertainment. And, you know, those are areas in which we have core competency, which we've covered. The major changes, I would go to Europe in the mid 70s to see all the car companies, go to Japan and China in the early 80s. But we never invested until the Berlin Wall came down in November of 1989. Then we said, not only do we want to cover companies around the world, but we want to invest in them for our clients. And that's it.
But it must have been very unusual for people to go outside the U.S. because the U.S. is a very big market and you've got home expertise. Why did you have the confidence to do that? Was it because you'd covered the stocks for a long time? You that built up your comfort level or?
No, my clients were primarily U.S.-based, but my research, when I was at Loeb Rhodes or William D. Witter, and when I started my own firm, you know, you want to follow industries. So if you're following media and entertainment, you know, that's one thing. Another classic example of what we followed is whatever you drink, wherever you drink it, whether wine, water, beer, soda, we would follow it. So that would take me to visit companies in Paris like Pernod or Grand Met in London. They had hamburgers and they had Guinness and they had booze. And I like that. So we, you know, we cover the industries and we still do. In other words, even though I have an analyst in China, we're not interested much in China as we're interested in what's going on in media or sports or dynamics like that. And so as a result of that, you know, we do have clients that don't allow us to hedge the currency. So that's been a challenge because if you bought something with the euro at 135 and it's down to 107, you could be up in local currency, but reporting it in U.S. dollars to the client has been a challenge.
We've had the opposite here, of course, because some well-known investors are trumpeting the fact that they did okay in 2022, down, you know, 10, 15%. But of course, they're mainly on dollar stocks and their real underlying loss has been significantly more. But just before we get onto that, because I wanted to ask you, you studied accounting and philosophy at university. At college, school. I never know how Americans pronounce it.
No, that's fine. What happened was not complicated. I needed to figure out how to be economic. And I was making tax returns out for individuals, whether they worked at the UN or whether they had small businesses when I was a freshman in college. And so I took accounting. And if you took accounting at the school I went to, you took what I call 32 credits of it. And you had a mandatory 24 credits of philosophy. They didn't have many options, but I got full tuition to that school. So, you know, I was able to cobble it together for a variety of sources. And as a result of that, you know, it was a practical decision.
And what have you learned from studying philosophy? How's that helped you in your business and in life?
That's a great question. One of the answers would be as follows. If I'm in the woods and a tree falls, if no one is there a sound? Come on, you know, I'll never answer that question. I'm still thinking about it 65 years later.
I'm just curious. My elder boy is doing his GCSEs, which are the sort of before the final exams. And he's doing 11 GCSEs and then he is specialized and he will do 4 A levels. And one of the A levels is philosophy. And he's doing economics. I can help him with that. But philosophy, I don't know that I'm going to be much help. Well,
just pass on the subject, and there are a lot of courses. Somebody says to me, "How did 4 years of Latin help you?" Well, it lets you organize structures of paragraph sentences so that you can go from A, B, C, D as opposed to A, D, B, C, as other people do sometimes when they don't.
I think Latin's a great language to learn. Really helps you.
It was an important structural process for me.
And listen, you set up your research firm in the 1970s, close to a really bad time in the market. You set up an institutional research firm. What gave you the confidence to do that? Have you always been a very confident person?
Yeah, no, I'm always believe in the freedom of the economy and the free market and with all the flaws and the rule of law. But what happened was I was at a firm called William D. Witter. May of 75 comes along. That was when commissions changed. May Day, they call it. You had the same thing on the London Exchange a few years later, probably in the mid-80s, if I remember.
1985, yeah.
Yeah, and basically what then happened is that all the research firms went out of business. So I was offered a job at XYZ. I had a friend of mine running the research department at Goldman Sachs. But when I went to see a client in Denver, Colorado, just before I made a decision while I was still at Drexel Burnham, Drexel had bought William D. Witter. The guy says to me, "What are you doing? Go start your own firm." And I had thought about it. And, I tried to raise X dollars. I couldn't do it. But I started it anyway. I figured the worst that could happen. And I had firms like General Motors and others that would pay $5,000 a year to buy my research. And that was a lot of, you needed cash flow to feed the family. So that was it. But I felt stocks were cheap. They got a lot cheaper over the next couple of years. And that's how we came up with the idea of private market value. What would a public, I had to convince individuals that there were organizations and families that had money and that they would take a publicly traded stock that was selling at X and they would buy it because of the, so that would mean what was the private market value of that company? And so we went through that process and identified that and coined that and trademarked that process back in the late 1970s. So private market value, PMV with a catalyst. And we did it because of economic necessity. I had to convince people to, give us money to invest.
That presumably would have been a very successful strategy at that time. I mean, do you think that would be possible today? Because, a lot of the less efficient companies have been acquired by private equity or consolidated. Multiples are higher today. And there's a lot more money chasing sort of risk and merger arbitrage. If you were doing it today, would you have done the same thing?
Going back to the analysis part, you basically started off saying, if I was a private equity, it's called leverage buyout at the time. Okay, prior to that in the 60s, it was called bootstrap financing. But if I look at what does a private equity firm do, whether it's Blackstone, KKR, the ones in London or so on, they try to promise their investors a certain rate of return. So when you buy a company, let's use hypothetically with no CapEx required, let's buy the company at a 10 multiple. How much debt can they take on? How much cash will the company be able to maintain its EBITDA or cash flow? Will they be able to grow it? And then what valuation can you put on it 5 years later if you want to sell it to another organization? And how much debt can they put on? And what's the cost of interest during that period? Clearly, as interest rates go up, the present value of what you think you can sell it for does not go up unless they're inflation indexed earnings. And so the private market value works in that regard. Where it has trouble is when you have a company with cash burn selling at a multiple of revenues. And so we do not attempt to do the private market value with companies like that.
You still use that philosophy, though?
Yes. For example, I'm reading a company this morning, Monarch Cement, located somewhere in Kansas, Hutchinson, Kansas. 4 million shares. The stock's 110. They've got 120 million in cash, which is $30 a share. They do 50 million of EBITDA, and it's extremely well run. And what they do is they sell cement. And so you try to figure out if I was another company that wanted to be in that area. Now, why you want to do that is if you put up, wind towers, you need a lot of cement. If you put up long distance lines for utility distribution, and then you have highway infrastructure funds and the government passed two bills that are very important. So that's what we do. Within the last 24 hours, I think 20 annual reports have come in. So that's what I do. I try to, I fast forward them. A Goodyear tire, for example, was painstakingly detailed. So that took a little longer this morning.
But so Monarch Cement, I mean, it's on like 6x EBITDA, and you've got the Inflation Reduction Act. I mean, what am I missing?
Nothing. You just look at the balance sheet, look at Walter Wolf has been running it forever. And the other part is he's been buying back stock. So where's my downside? The problem is he trades 100 shares a day. Okay. So you don't, it's not liquid. It's not appropriate for, you know, anyone that is concerned about dynamics to trade it. But in talking about the methodology of analysis, how do I look at private market value? Okay. So we, ideal world is to look on the ignored and unloved. And those are small cap stocks like Monarch. Monarch has a 400 million, as you point out, but the multiple, the 50 million of EBITDA is materially lower than it could be, but that's not why I looked at it. I'm looking at today, for example, in the United States, there are TV station operators. They've been hit hard because of the concerns over an economic contraction. But when you look into 2024, you'll see a tsunami of spending on politics, and you'll see a recovery in automobile spending, and you'll see a recovery in other types of spending. And so if you buy these stocks in an economic contraction that the market's assuming is an economic contraction, and you say, how bad is bad? How long will it be bad? Can this company have a balance sheet and an income statement to survive? And then how good is good? And when will good be good? And when will the market discount it? So there's a lot of old ways of making money in cyclicals and small cap and the ones that could be taken over. The challenges are always, you know, do I worry about Samar in China? Do I worry about what's going on in Belgium? Do I worry about what's going on in Washington in terms of regulation? Sure. It's getting harder and harder on M&A to predict with clarity the time frame in which the announced deal and the closing process will take place.
But you care.
Of course. My job is to, we have separately managed accounts, so we try to do two things, judgment and service. And on judgment side, that's why we have the analysts and the portfolio managers. On the service side, that's why we have our teammates who, you know, contact clients in periods like last Monday when they had runs on a bank and you have to explain to them. And that's where the accounting comes in, where you dig out FASB 157 and accounting standard 157, blah, blah, blah. It came about because of what happened in 1990 in the bank crisis in the United States. And that bank crisis dealt with the Savings and Loan Association. So the accountants passed the rule, Steve, that said, if you buy a long-term asset and you put it into a category called hold to maturity, HTM, you don't have to mark to market. So they take that was good for the last 12 years. But all of a sudden, when rates go from 0 to 5%, you and your long government bonds, the value has come down. And all of a sudden, if you picked up First Republic's annual report and looked at that number, which they gave you, and it was available that Monday when SIVB had gone bust or whatever, basically, you would see that they had like $4 billion of a $13 billion capital base. And so that was really an accounting bluff. And so that's how you pick and tie all this data together.
If you enjoy this podcast, you're bound to enjoy our free newsletter on Substack. It's a weekly email on interesting investing topics. Visit behindthebalancesheet.com and hit the sign up button. While you're there, you might want to check out our brilliant online investor training school. Hundreds of students have taken our flagship Analyst Academy course, which teaches you everything you need to become a serious equity investor. And if you're a professional investor, we run a forensic accounting course for institutional clients, and soon a cohort-based course for serious amateurs. Email us at info@behindthebalancesheet.com.
Why is it that people don't read the 10Ks? Because that information's there. You know, I mean, it's not difficult to read it, right?
I mean, let's be practical. Individual clients are not going to read that material. Okay. So, therefore, owning an ETF for them, if they want to be passive about doing that, since 1928, when they put these numbers in a bucket, I have the data, I can send it to you. By decade, it was put together by Ibbotson. They went back retroactively and put it together and so on, that you could have compounded your assets at about a 10.1% CAGR, okay? I think over the next decade, you probably, because of the rising interest rates, which are going to be embedded longer, that you probably assume you can make a 6 to 8%. So, you know, an individual investor looking at alternatives for money and liquidity, I can live with that. But if you're talking about an active analyst or a portfolio manager, they should read it. That's their job. That's what they get paid for. And so as a result of that, with the changing market, you eliminated the uptick rule in the United States, which means they can short. The ETFs come along, they can hit them, they buy these bundles, they come up with crazy packages, you know, where you get doubles, triples, ETFs, but the quants and the algos and the momos, everyone tries to make money in their own methodology, and some are very successful. And we try to do the same thing in our methodology. Our methodology is of being a bottoms up, focused on areas in which we have developed core competencies over an extended period of time.
And how much of that is based on looking at the financials and looking at the internals of the companies, and how much of it is based on looking at the industries and the knowledge of the industry? I know you're a very big reader of, personally, of trade journals. Just, can you talk a little bit about your process? Because a lot of people listening to this podcast, a lot of young listeners who are trying to learn their craft, and it'd be fantastic if you wouldn't mind just explaining how you go about looking at a stock.
Well, that's a great question. Let's start off by saying the first thing you have to do to be successful is decide to work from 5 to 9. Everybody else wants to work from 9 to 5. And that is a real cultural shift in the United States recently that convinced people to do that. The second part is you can't go in and follow one company selling pumps and valves without following the whole ecosystem. You cannot follow Warner Brothers Discovery or Netflix by not looking at the content providers and the other companies that are doing streaming. So what we do is we assign an analyst, for example, we believe that you will have renewable energy or some other form of energy, so sources of energy. So you do transmission, you do distribution. So we send an analyst or team of two now to industry conferences, the electrical EII. Okay, we have a guy in London that would cover Gamesa and the wind companies, and they talk, but do not, you can't just do a one-off. So reading the trade magazines, going to conferences, going to see the companies at their headquarters, it's been a little challenging until more recently, just travel because you didn't know whether you'd get back, you didn't know what the COVID issues were. But bottom line, that's the structural way that we believe in and emphasize. Then what you do is you try to get a good management with a good business, a good management with at a reasonable price. Sometimes you get a good management, a good business, and the price is a little higher, where then I don't have that same margin of safety. But the stock still goes up, but that's okay. We try to determine, I'm going to Atlanta, Georgia tomorrow to visit a company that I first visited in 1967, and I still own the stock for clients called Genuine Parts. They sell parts for the auto aftermarket. Clearly, there's some concerns that an EV is going to have less parts, but they'll have different parts. And then in addition to that, the company is going into the distribution of product parts in Europe and Australia and New Zealand. And the world has 1.4 billion cars, and they're getting older. And so, they need parts. And when you go to get, if your car doesn't work, you don't want to wait a week to get the right part. You want it the next day. So then in addition to that, the vendors of their parts allow them to return the parts. So it's not like a dress where the seasonality changes and that you have to take a markdown on your sneakers and move it out. They get paid. And secondly, the vendors finance their inventory. So on a non-recourse basis. And then in addition to that, if I have the parts for a 1954 Chevy or whatever, or not a Rolls, but a more common car, and you don't want it anymore, they take it back. So there's not that risk, and there's pricing discipline and so on. So we'll see the company, and they're going into distributing parts the same way for industrial activity. And you probably have the old idea of Kaizen, just-in-time inventory. That's going to change. And reshoring to Mexico and reshoring to parts of the countries to shorten the lead time. Like we were seeing a company the other day that had a significant facility in Morocco. Well, they're in Tangier. Well, that's right across the river. So that's what we do.
What's it like when you go and visit a company that you've known for all that time? You've got more knowledge, understanding, history with the business than the chief executive.
No, not necessarily, but I approach the questions into more detail on gross margins, cost of goods sold, SG&A expenses. The CEO does know what his competitors are doing. I'm visiting all the competitors. He does know what the board is thinking of strategy because he's told them. The challenges are that you have to be very careful when you visit companies to get that obviously if anybody tells you something that's material non-public, we have to make it public. Okay. Because we've been following the company for an extended period of time, we do understand certain dynamics. We understand, where is the company thinking 5 years from now? But short-term mechanics, those are challenging. For example, I'm not sure I would be aware of all of their suppliers of parts in the case of Genuine Parts where I'm going tomorrow. Will one of them have a shortage, which that company that supplies that part is private? The trades don't pick up that news, that noise. you know, and the competitors are using a different supplier of that part. So there are certain elements that you don't find out about. But you also have to keep track of these companies that are trying to, let's say, make it clear that they take write-offs of goodwill, or they take concerns over changes in accounting, and they provide data that the next year they tell you, oh, our earnings were $1 versus 40 cents from a year ago, but they don't tell you they wrote down 60 cents the year before. You know, so you got to keep track of data by quarter, and our spreadsheets do that, okay? What are the gross margins for the SG&A? And then service business don't have the same kind of inventories. Our inventories on LIFO, as the management learned how to control working capital, this is a new generation of managers that have not done that. And I'll give you an example, Steve. A few years ago, when the first oil crisis hit, you would rent the car company would pay for the gas. Within 2 years, they gave you the car, but you paid for the gas as extra. So the notion of cost pass-throughs, baking it into contracts, is new. Now, the United States, as an example, we are probably 20-odd% of the U.S. is manufacturing today, whereas in the 70s, it was much higher percentage. You become more of a service economy, so you have to understand the implications of service costs and how they deal with CapEx and cash flow. So it's okay.
So when you go tomorrow to Genuine Parts, just run us through your day. I mean, do you always have the same questions you ask companies?
No. The company is bringing in investors from across the world, and they're bringing in management from across the world. They start at 7:30 in the morning, so we have to leave at like 4 o'clock to get on an airplane.
Whoa. You're getting up at 4 o'clock.
No, I'm getting up earlier than that. That's not relevant. The point is, you got to get to the airport by a certain hour to get a certain flight to get down there. And it's they look, yeah, we'll do it. That's nothing. Why? What's this?
But Mario, look, you know, you're not a young man now. You're very wealthy. You could afford to fly down tonight and stay in a hotel. And
but I have other things to do tonight, see other clients and so on. Independent of that, the point is that I used to go to Europe 2 or 3 times a year. I haven't been to London since June of last year, okay? I've got to get up there 2 or 3 times between that and going to see companies in Paris and Berlin. And then, Japan, that's another challenge for us, okay? I have one guy working in Shanghai who's an analyst that was with me for 20 years, and he decided to go. We opened the office there 15 years, and a whole bunch of interesting dynamics going on. I may not invest in them, but certainly want to see them. And so Toronto, Montreal, I mean, you know, we got a backlog of companies to visit. You cannot worry about personal impact that you shouldn't be managing money for other people.
Well, that's very commendable. And I'm just amazed. I'm laughing because I'm amazed that you still have the will.
Hey, stop. 4:30 is not that early. Come on. If you want to work from 5 to 9, you know. You get up earlier, 1 hour earlier one day. What's the difference?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't do that, but I'm not as dedicated. I'm not as rich as you. So, you know,
Stop. All the money I make incrementally is going to charity anyway. So that's irrelevant.
But tell me, this geographical coverage, just talk a little bit about, you know, where you've got boots in the ground and why do you need boots in the ground in an information age?
First of all, like in Shanghai, and I'll give you Tokyo. When we go there, clearly I will need somebody that, you know, we tell them, hey, we've had the office here since Fukushima. We're there 12 years or 11 years. And if I needed to understand the culture of how to ask a question, I ask in advance. Sometimes I'm very direct. Sometimes you have to go through a side door. Secondly, they do take you around and they know the traffic patterns and so on. So visit companies, okay? Clearly, you can rent a car, but I'd like to also understand more about the company and the culture. When we go to Shanghai, the same thing. Hong Kong, my analyst has disappeared until recently. But let's take London, okay? We have 4 or 5 teammates in London. One covers the healthcare stock, so we'll see GSK. The other one will go take me over to Rolls-Royce down the block. And, whether I go see Vodafone or I go see other companies, Ashtead, because we also are large holders in the U.S. of what they do. And, you know, that's another example. Tim Winter, my utility analyst, he lives in St. Louis. He wouldn't join me if I had to come to New York or Connecticut. So we opened an office in St. Louis. He's been there with us now 15 years, and he's one of the best in covering the water industries. Like Severin Trent, we have an analyst in London that goes there, and I come over and see Liz Garfield whenever, you know, I get there again. It is what it is. You, But the advantage of having there is a little bit of a benefit if you're seeing companies in the geographic area. So that's important. Secondly, it's important if you want to have an individual who has talent, but he doesn't want to relocate to a geographic area like New York. And yet he's, you know, gets on an airplane and goes to conferences around the world. You know, we have an analyst that grew up in the Ukraine and moved to Cleveland, and he's been with me for 20 years, and he just came back from Barcelona for a telecom conference. So we do all of that. Gather the information, array the information, project it, interpret, and communicate. Our investment research process is what they call GAPIC. It's areas like telecom where we have historical knowledge. Like today, a company in Belgium based in London called Liberty Global is buying the balance in of their telenet. They offered 35 euros, I'm going to say 9 years ago. Today, they're offering 22. What's going on in Belgium? Evan Miller was the analyst at Lehman Brothers in London back in 1989 or 90 or 88. And he's still with us today. And he decided he wanted to cover these companies out of Milan. Okay, so why not?
And how do you communicate? I mean, I know it's easier.
Another good question. We start every morning at 8:15 New York time. So, for example, Evan jumped in on a dialogue over what's going on in Belgium, how many telecom operators there are, what Liberty Global is doing there, why they're doing it. We speculate on that. Another teammate understands the squeeze-out rules in Belgium or EU, and that if they can get 95%, they can squeeze out the balance on a merger. So you tie all of that together. Today, as an example, we also discussed several companies that reported earnings. Obviously, our money market team talked about what the Federal Open Market Committee is going to do today at 2 o'clock. We run a 100% U.S. Treasury fund. There's tax benefits to that. There's no liquidity issues. And, the team's been doing it for 30 years. So they bring us up to date on what they think the rates are going to do and what the runoff is going to do. The Fed's got $9 trillion of debt that they've up from five. They're reducing it at $95 billion a month. And they just added $300 billion back into the system. So, you keep track of all these things. And that's how we communicate. That doesn't mean it's a perfect world. Again, some of the individuals have not kept up with the passion, what I call the PhD attitude. They're not as passionate, hungry, and driven as they might have been pre-COVID.
Oh, really? Have you noticed that there's been a change in attitude?
Yeah, there's no question about it.
And that surprises me at your firm, because I would have thought that nobody would get into your firm unless they were pretty hungry.
No. Getting in is one thing. Maintaining the function and focus and integrity of the process that is important for our clients, which is judgment and service, requires a little more reexamination and going back to basics. People change. Look, I mean, I had one analyst I hired from a state in the United States that probably never had snow. After his first winter, I sent him to visit a company in Los Angeles. He decided never to come back. He quit. Come on. You're dealing with people. Okay. Yeah. Everyone is different. We tolerate all. We respect all. However, we also have to be practical.
What's employee turnover like at a firm like yours? I imagine you've got long tenure, haven't you?
We don't have that much. We have maybe three individuals leave us out of about 180. Most of the ones that left recently was because they wanted to be geographically closer to work. They did not want to commute to Rye, wherever we are. Okay. So it's like saying, the way I want to work and be able to walk 10 blocks to work as opposed to taking a half hour train ride or something like that.
Yeah, well, that's...
That would change attitudes about locations for some individuals.
Tell me, I've heard you tell the story about when you originally set up the firm as an institutional research firm, and obviously research is still the backbone. But when you were visiting a company, you said that the company director, the chief executive, gave you a check. Can you tell that story? Because I think it's fascinating.
You've got too good a story memory. What happened was the following. I cover the auto industry. So I cover all the parts companies, shock absorbers, exhaust systems, blah, blah, whatever was popular in the 1970s and 60s. I go to Toronto. I visit a guy by Vanderhout, public company. I'm thinking about his stock. And he says to me about 45 minutes into the interview, Mario, stop. You know more about the Canadian auto market than I can tell you anymore. Okay. Then he says to me, Mario, tell me about your business. So I tell him, here's what I'm doing. I'm doing research. I'm sending out reports. He says, you're going to fail. I said, Jack, why do you say that? He opens the drawer, pulls out his check for $100,000. He says, you forgot to ask for the order. Remember the 11th commandment. If you don't ask, you don't get. So as a result of that, Steve, that was the story there. He became my first client. It was 3 weeks later. And then when I started, it must have been like October, I said January, late January. And the company Vanderhout was a very successful distributor of auto parts. And they had the license to distribute XYZ shock absorbers and stuff like that, which I was following the American company that made that stuff. So, you know, that was an incrementally value-added visit.
Well, did you get, was a good stock idea as well? You were happy with $100,000?
We made a lot of money. His grandson worked for me for a while and went back to Toronto, and we try to keep in touch even with all the challenges.
What made him trust you? It was $100,000 back
oh,
in...
Oh, no, because I would ask all of the probing questions for an extended period of time. He knew what I was doing. I would send him copies of my research report. You know, and when I was either at Lowbrows or William D. Witter, the analysts were permitted to have private accounts. So I would have private accounts, even though most of the other analysts may not have been so interested in it. So I would talk to these individuals over an extended period of time about dynamics going on in the market, what's going on with the oil shocks. You know, and I knew about a lot of data on automobile consumption, parts, cars on the road, trends, pricing. And we would exchange data as well as me learning more about what's going on in Western Canada, Canadian auto, whatever's going on at competitors. So that's why he came up with that database and knowledge.
And how then did you grow the money management side of the business? You carried on doing research or?
Yeah, no, I still do that. My wife reads five annual reports and she reads one book. So she will read five books a week and I'll read 20 annual reports or something. It is what it is. That's why I'm having trouble thinking about the way to answer your question, which I will in a minute, about what book to recommend.
But the one thing you do is you've been doing an auto conference for almost 50 years and various other conferences have been going on forever. Who attends those?
Okay, that's a good question. Let's do it the following way. I had to give a speech in Las Vegas to an auto industry group. Automotive warehouse distributors or whatever. And it was in 1972 or 3 or 4. And I said to them, the biggest problem you have is not the availability of oil. I think that'll be resolved itself. It'll just be a higher price. But you have is a cost of capital because inflation is going to pick up and you guys are going to have to communicate with Wall Street. So because of that, I started hosting a meeting in Las Vegas because the industry would go there. So 46 years later, the industry goes there at the end of October, early November, and we always host our meetings there. We started the same thing with us parts suppliers to Boeing and Airbus. So we have a conference now, maybe 35, 36 years. So instead of just going to Farnborough, going to Paris air shows, you know, we have our conference. That's generally in New York. It's generally in September. We do one on pump valve and motors. We do it on recycling companies, for example, why is aluminum important in the world in which we worry about plastics in the world? Why? Then we do one on media and entertainment. Then we do one on specialty chemicals, which we just did last week. And then we the one that is coming up about 30 years ago, Alice Schroeder was at Morgan Stanley. She hosted a dinner the night before a Buffett's annual meeting. I would get invited by her. Warren would show up. She writes a book called XYZ on Warren Buffett. It says, I'm not doing this anymore. I call him up. I say, Warren, my nickel, your guest list. Mario, I'm not doing it. I said, okay, Warren, how about Columbia's guest list and my nickel? He said, great. So we, for the last 17 years, Columbia Business School, where Warren went, in quotes, under Graham, they bring the guest in on a Friday night. So we have a conference, okay? But that morning, we bring in three or four local companies like Lindsay and Valmont, which meant Central irrigation equipment and so on. And then two or three others come in and we talk about those companies. And then that evening, we have 400 or 500 individuals show up at the dinner.
400 or 500?
Yeah. They pay a dollar. Columbia gets $4. I pay a certain amount for the food. I pay for everything. And Columbia gets the money that they charge.
Oh, I see. All right. So they pay quite a lot, I imagine.
What are you going to do? So it's not, $50, if you pay somebody 50 pounds today, it's probably what you would have paid 5 years ago, 25.
Yeah, well, I mean, food prices here are rocketing up.
I agree. We've got a food crisis, energy crisis, a water crisis, and obviously now we've got a little bank issues.
What did you make of, so I should just explain, because this will go out in a few weeks, that we're recording this the week after Silicon Valley Bank has been rescued. What do you make of that? I mean, you've seen this How many times have you seen bank failures? I mean, it's quite common in the States.
In the late 60s, the chemical bank, somebody tried to take it over. You had some problems in the early 70s. In the United States, in the mid-70s, you had Republic Bank, Continental Illinois Bank, Herstatt Bank. Companies went bust. In the late 80s, you had all the savings and loans. In the OOs, you had something else. 08, 09, you had the Lehmans and the Bears. And today, you're just going back to the cycle. It was a long period of time in which deposits were lazy. They didn't care whether they earned 1%. They'd just leave the money to banks. The banks then said, we can earn net interest margin spread by going out and we don't have to worry about the accounting. And so you had those challenges. I would thought that the problems would be private equity. You know, the late 80s, you also had the collateralized loan obligations. You know, I thought it would be private credit, shadow banking, all these loans that are being made by non-regulated entities. I still think that's going to be a problem.
This isn't the end, right? I mean, this is just the beginning.
Look, from my end, I'm not an expert on this. I think that the notion of $250,000, what happened is that if you go back to see the movie A Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart, 1946, I happen to know these because I follow the movie industry. Basically, it showed you what happens when a run on a bank. So the bank crisis of the 1930s, you had people peeing up trying to get their money out. Today, a guy sits on his desk, hits a button and says, I want my money back. OK, so the new run on a bank, it just happens. And as a result of that, if you had X dollars in a bank and somebody says you're not guaranteed, you're going to meet payroll, all of a sudden you wake up and say, look, I had a good relationship with SIVB, but I want my money back. So I think for the short term, they did a bailout. How that works out over time, I don't know. And I just trying to think about Hamilton and Alexander Byrd that created some challenges back 250 years ago. Look, J.P. Morgan, the crisis. You had so many bank crises. I think the Financial Times or someone wrote down the list starting Mackey wrote the book in 1853, Delusions of Grandeur. I forget the year, but I'm close. You know, look at the South China Sea bubble, the blah, blah, blah. You always get these bubbles. And that's the good news about the capitalistic system.
The problem you don't have any banks, do you? Because if I look at your top holdings.
No. We are, when you look at my portfolios, you'll see that I am a big believer in custodial banks. State Street and Bank of New York are two of our biggest holdings. And I started buying those in the late 2006, 7, 8. When a crisis was, I said these custody banks will do okay. But you also have to realize that I do own kind of surrogate banks like American Express. I own for clients Berkshire Hathaway.
It's not a surrogate bank, is it?
And we do have a few shares of some of the banks that were local. For example, the migration of individuals from the northern part of the United States to the south. The banks that are down there would be attractive to regional banks to buy the Florida, Georgia banks. Okay, so we look at several of those. But it's not, you know, if you're talking about a 3 or 4% holdings of 5% of banks, it's a lot. But the state, they're overwhelmed by Bank of New York and State Street.
And why are those safe?
You know, because if you are worried about, I'm not worried about anything, but let's assume I was concerned about a return of capital as opposed to return on capital. Having your money in a brokerage firm, you're only secured up to a certain amount. If you have your money on margin, it becomes cross-collateralized with the assets. So you don't want to have a margin account. You want to have an account where you're delivering the assets to a bank that those assets are not commingled with the bank's assets. So they're called custodial assets. And so we use them for our mutual funds. We use State Street, and we know the quality of the service. We know that doesn't mean they don't make mistakes in terms of making acquisitions or overpaying or maybe underpaying for something that they should have bought earlier. But on balance, my assets are segregated. So there's, I don't want to use another, 30 shades of green. I don't want to say.
You're buying those, but you're not taking a risk on the capital because they're basically.
They provide a judgment and service, and clearly we like that aspect of them. One of them, like Bank of New York, has got a $50 billion market cap. So at some point, we figured they would also be the subject of someone's lovemaking. That's kind of on hold for the next time period at the moment.
I wanted to ask you, because when I was looking through your website, you're described as a CIO value, and there's also a CIO growth. And I've never seen that distinction before. And I've always thought of sort of growth and value being two sides of the same coin. Why do you have two? Is it because you need a different mindset to invest in growth? Is that the reason?
Do it another way. If you were a general in the military, what you want to do is give ribbons out. So Howard Ward has been running our growth team for 30 years. He's done a fantastic job. Caesar Bryant, for example, runs our gold team. He was a barrister. He sold his wig, his robe, and he went to work for Montague as a sell-side analyst. He's been doing it for us now for 32 years. So he covers the gold stocks. We have a team that does convertibles. We have somebody else that does some minor fixed income. I have two individuals, Kevin Dreyer and Chris Morangi, are co-CIOs with me in the value side of the house. Okay, and the reason for that is a kind of a, the board asked, what if I am walking down the street and somebody shoots me? I said, you know, such is life. But that's to plan for the notion of continuation of judgment. That's why that part of the business makes sense. To continue the notion of running the business, we just created a co-CEO office, and we will, the board knows, just in case something happens, who's going to run the business for until they figure out what they want to do. So you have to be practical in these decisions.
So so my real question is, okay, so I look at Meta. Is it value or is it growth?
I got it. When I do, as I started the conversation earlier, my private market value with a catalyst, which is the basis of our value team, you can't do that with companies like Meta. Okay, unless you're looking at doing financial engineering and the splitting off the company and doing three or four subsets. That clearly, when you have you cannot do private market value on a company with $800 billion of market cap. You can't do it on a Microsoft, even though they have parts that, you know, they're going to buy Activision, they're going to compete with Sony. But then you look at Sony, and Sony has 1.3 billion shares and the stock is selling at 90. You know, you got a $1,200 billion market cap. Can they split it up? Can we look at the sum of the parts there? How much is music? Then you have comps with regards to Spotify paying them. You have Universal Music. You have Warner Music in New York, which we just visited. And so then you have obviously all of the PlayStation, and then you have Game Pass. And so you can start seeing what's going on in that part of the world. You want to have growth. You want a good management. You want to have a good business with good values. So sometimes you can blur that line, and your observation is totally accurate. You know, clearly it's going to be very hard to put Microsoft in the value camp. Some people do that, not my church, not the way we look at it, okay?
But on the growth side of the office, do they look at stocks in a different way?
Oh, yeah, they're looking at totally different. Howard has basically looking at the growth of the addressable market, the growth of the company's market share. How do they allocate capital? How does the balance sheet look? He tends not to look at startups, okay, with his cash burn for 3 years. Then in between that, or like in London, Sarah Woger was in our London office. She would look at Exact Sciences, which is colonoscopy and other things. And they got cash burn and, you know, for 3 years, but they have enough cash not to have to raise cash to fund the time to get the cash break even. So that could either be a growth or value play. When the stock dropped to $45, you know, I bought some.
And, all right. So you do get a bit of a crossover.
Well, you know, we take a very practical approach. We had Scott's Miracle-Gro, which got crushed by its cannabis exposure. But we knew it because it was also a lawn and garden. And lawn and garden in the United States in the spring of 2022 was terrible because of weather conditions. But they have an entrenched brand. The stock dropped from 150 to 40, or 5 or 50. And, you know, we said we can buy it in the value side.
Funny. The London Value Investor Conference, which I shouldn't advertise since they won't give me a free ticket, but they, you know, Jonathan Boyer.
They should throw petals on the floor for you.
Well, I mean, I think it's perfectly reasonable to give me a free ticket if I'm going to write about it, right? I mean, but anyway, they want me to pay.
There's various types of people in the world that are very practical. They call them Scotch and Genovese.
Anyway, so I'm debating whether to go, and I shouldn't publicize, so we'll edit out the name of the nameless conference. But Jonathan Boyer presented several ideas, but he presented Scott's last year, and it looks quite an interesting company to me. I don't know, the share price it's been pretty weak. But
well, the stock dropped down to 40, it got bounced back to 80, and it's probably in the 70s today. I don't have the current price in front of me. I don't have a machine, gold machine. But bottom line, those are the kinds of things that one keeps on their radar screen, because if you follow the company when it's located in Long Island and then move it out to Ohio, the guy I would visit with was here, you see, the change taking place. I don't buy three-dimensional printing until now. I don't buy cannabis. There's certain things that we're unlikely to hold for our clients. You know, too much easy competition. It's not worth it. No barriers to entry, blah, blah, blah.
Do you think value is back? David Einhorn was over in London a few months ago trying to raise capital. He's up 36% net last year. Now's your day in the sun again, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I mean, in 1999, Buffett stock was $42,000. People thought value was dead. Dot-com was in. They booed him. He had to advertise literally in his annual report, "You're not happy with me. Here's my phone number. I'll buy your stock." Okay, in 1975, we had the same problem at Columbia Business School, value investing, 72 at the Nifty 50. So Wall Street goes through cycles in which you have different dynamics. I'm not saying value ever left. I think the consultants looked on value as leaving. Your clients buying a business that's run well at a reasonable price, and you hold it for a period of time. In the United States, they're going to try to change this rule. But if you hold a stock over a year, you're paying a 23.8% tax. If you hold it under a year, you're paying a 37% plus whatever your state and local taxes are. That's why everybody wants to move to Zug.
Well, Zug, there's no taxes. So a friend of mine...
We know. We got it. But in order to exit the United States, though, you got problems. Puerto Rico is probably the best case right now in the U.S.
Well, I said to my friend, I said, "What are you going to do in Zug?"
And he said, "Steve, you go to Zurich. You can go to Zurich, which is only a 25-minute drive or something like that."
Yeah, but I mean, what do you do in Zurich? I mean, Zurich's civilized city, but I live in London.
Yeah, I know. You go down to what's that
you
place?
You live in New York.
What's the place at the bottom of Portugal? They're called
Algarve. So tell me, what book are you going to recommend to my listeners?
Well, I'm a value guy. I don't want you to pay for it. I want you to go back and get 3 years of annual reports on Berkshire Hathaway. It's online. You get it for nothing. Just read the chairman's letters about how he approaches the world. Okay. And that is a very good insight into how someone invests money and has done it for 40 years, 50 years, what year are we in? 60 years. And, from my point of view, if I wanted to read a book, I will send everyone a copy of Merger Masters, which we wrote. It deals with arbitrageurs and the art of arbitrage. All of them have been extraordinarily successful investors. And what did they do and how do they treat arbitrage? Arbitrage is financial engineering, but under it is the M&A. It's called Merger Masters, but I will not recommend it. I will send it. I cannot have anyone buy something that, I had some fingerprints on. But the one that I always recommended for the last 50 years or 40 years, since 1966, Graham and Dodd's book on security analysis. Okay. And, just understand one aspect of the investing world, and that aspect deals with fundamental investing. You're buying a piece of land, you're buying a stock, you're buying a piece of a company because you're buying one share. And how does that what do they do over the next 10 or 20 years? And which ones are going to be around?
Well, listen, I mean, it's so much fun and interest talking to you. I really...
Oh, you're right. You're so kind. I'll have to buy you a beer at the...
Well, I'm really annoyed because you've been in London and you haven't called me up because we were going to have a beer. And
wait, hold on. I came into London. I landed at 8 o'clock one night to see the office, see my team in June. I went to see Christopher Mills. I saw two companies that morning, and then we left at 1 o'clock to go some other part of the world. So sorry about that. It was an absentia.
Well, look, next time you have to stay a bit longer. And
Steve, we will. Cheers. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
As I said at the beginning, my original idea behind this podcast was to inspire young people to have a career as an analyst. That has been so rewarding for me personally. It transpired the quality of some of my guests has interested a lot of professional investors, and the show has a big following in that community. The fact that Mario Gabelli started work in 1967 as an autos analyst, and he is still following genuine parts 56 years later, just amazes me. More so, that he's getting up in the middle of the night in his 80s so he doesn't miss their Capital Markets Day. If you're a young person wondering about a career in finance, I hope this inspires you. If you're a professional investor, maybe you need to work harder. Thank you for listening.